The Supreme Court delivers Indiana a win and a loss. Governor Holcomb's teacher pay commission meets in secret. That, plus the DNC raises its debate threshold, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 31st, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the U.S. Supreme Court delivered both a win and a loss to Indiana as it ruled on a 2016 anti-abortion lawsuit. An anti-abortion law from 2016 required medical facilities to bury or cremate fetal remains rather than dispose of them as medical waste. It also banned abortions performed solely because of a fetus's characteristics, such as gender or disability. Planned Parenthood sued to strike down those portions of the law, and both a federal district judge and the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals sided with the healthcare organization. But the Supreme Court says the fetal remains provision doesn't create an undue burden on women who seek an abortion, and so that part of the law will now take effect. Yet the fetal characteristics abortion ban will remain struck down. The court opted not to hear arguments on that provision for a technical reason. It says because the issue hasn't come up in multiple courts of appeals, it isn't ready for review by the Supreme Court. What does the court's decision tell us about future abortion battles in the courts? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Lindsay Erdody, state government reporter for the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly, state house reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting state house reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, if you're someone who wants to see Roe versus Wade overturned, how are you feeling about these rulings?
Well, disappointed in the short term, but maybe hopeful in the long term. And the dissenting opinions.
There wasn't even a dissent. So not a dissent.
There were other opinions written.
Rants written, actually.
Clarence Thomas in particular said, you know, we maybe do need time with this, but we're going to have to deal with it at some point. This isn't going away, particularly with how state legislatures are passing these bills up through the courts. But the court was consistent in how they handled
that hadn't percolated yet.
You know, Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas's comments were made me start thinking about this almost in terms of an Obamacare repeal. It felt great to say we're going to repeal Obamacare, and then when it came time, we went, oh, but then what happens, right? I mean, I'm starting to think about Roe v. Wade in that there's obviously no replacing abortion, so Obamacare went from repeal to repeal and replace to some other mechanism. You can't wake up tomorrow and nobody has insurance, right, if you just repeal that. And I think that's why we saw that law not get overturned even in the Republican Congress in the first 2 years of the Trump administration. But one thing that has occurred to me, you don't replace abortion, obviously, except that you don't get rid of the problem of unwanted pregnancy. And we've spent years now divesting from investments in family planning, not abortion, just family planning, just education. We had a proposal in Indiana that repealed or that made it illegal without parental permission to teach sex ed in classrooms. So we've created the conditions for more unwanted pregnancies, and now we're going to go in and repeal Roe v. Wade without really investing heavily like we would in making sure that we don't have some terrible black market outcome here. So I think, hopefully, in the years ahead, which is what it'll probably take, I would hope that Republicans in the legislature here and in Congress, if we're truly looking at a post-Roe v. Wade world, we invest in those things and recognize that we can't just ignore the problem.
If you're looking at these rulings, how are you feeling?
Let me first comment on something Mike said, because I thought that was actually a good answer to the question, which is
that's never good news for Mike.
Sharp contrast to most of them. But
typically, you peel my face off when we're talking about abortion.
But what I think is important to realize that when you have a Democratic administration in head in Washington, abortions go down, and when you have Republican administrations, abortions go up for precisely that reason, because we want to pretend that teenagers aren't going to have sex. We want to pretend that if we preach abstinence, that's all that has to happen, and unwanted pregnancies or any pregnancies will stop. In terms of this decision, it shows that if you want to oppose or overturn Roe v. Wade, or even if you want to keep it You don't rely on the Indiana legislature because they don't know how to pick an issue to set it before the Supreme Court. They didn't even allow a briefing on this before saying, no, there's no dispute within the circuits. The meat of this bill, so to speak, is the one that would have restricted the right to abortion. And they upheld the Seventh Circuit in that regard. Disposal of the fetal remains, okay. I mean, you could have a debate about what's appropriate for that. But I think the more fundamental question, besides teaching about sex education and hopefully teaching children to wait until they're mature enough to have sex, is the other part of that, is when does life begin? I mean, when you get some of these birthers, they want to think that as soon as the semen goes into the womb and fertilizes the egg, there's life. You know, well, there isn't. I mean, there's something, but there is no cognitive ability. There's no ability to live outside the womb. When do we define that? We haven't even had that discussion. They want to be absolutist about it. And, they don't want to provide for abortions in the event of rape or incest. What happens if you have an atopic pregnancy?
But what fuels the other extreme, what fuels that extreme is the other extreme, which is New York and Virginia. And at the moment of birth, you're aborted.
Both sides are guilty of going the extreme on this topic. I mean, I do think, I don't know how anyone looks at this ruling and doesn't see it as a bit of a hit, because everyone was hoping that this now conservative court would jump in on this topic, and they wouldn't even take sort of a smaller ban. You know, they're certainly not going to take a massive ban right off.
Yes, because those are coming too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I feel like every day I'm reading about more and more states either getting close to passing something or passing something. So more challenges are coming to the Supreme Court. And I think they were just saying, you know, right now we're not going to decide on this. But for the anti-abortion activists out there, I think it is a pretty good thing, because they weren't saying, we're never going to decide on this. We're never going to, talk about Roe versus Wade again. And they're out there seeing the same things that I'm reading. And so they know that it may not have happened today, but more stuff is on the way.
And time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. And this week's question: will the Supreme Court overturn Roe v. Wade within the next 5 years? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question: will Democratic presidential candidates' appearances on Fox News, like Pete Buttigieg's, help or hurt their campaigns? 83% of you say it's going to help. 17% say it'll hurt. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Governor Holcomb's commission to study lasting solutions to increase teacher pay has met several times so far, all in private. Holcomb announced the Next Level Teacher Compensation Commission in his State of the State address in January, and a new Chalkbeat report this week says the group has met at least 6 times since, but none of those meetings have been open to the public. That's drawn criticism from open government advocates and teachers who worry about the public and educators being shut out of the process. Commission Chair Mike Smith, a former transportation company CEO, says the meetings aren't secretive. He insists the initial gatherings are informational, as the members learn as much as possible about teacher pay issues. Holcomb's panel already drew scrutiny over the fact that it doesn't include any teachers, and there's only one educator on an advisory board meant to support the commission.
And Delaney, the commission will have open meetings later this year when they really start talking about the meat of these issues. So does that allay any concerns you might have?
Look, I mean, we just went through a legislative session where everything was decided by the supermajorities in caucus with very little floor debate on any important issue at all. So why is this any different? It isn't transparent at all. They can do whatever they want to do and not be held accountable for it. I mean, I think the bigger question here is that, as I understand what Mike Smith said, they don't even intend to report in until the 2020 session. So teachers can wait another 2 years before having any effective pay raises. We don't need to have even this commission or whatever it's called, next level commission. Well, the next level commission for teacher pay, because we know the teachers are underpaid. I mean, when Mitch Daniels took over responsibility for public education, why is it that when the state is providing the funds, the teachers in Rush County aren't paid the same as teachers in Hamilton County? We don't pay troopers in Rush County less than we pay the troopers in Hamilton County. I know the teachers are not state employees, but they are state funded. And I think it's time we recognize the fact that we expect these teachers to have bachelor's degrees. We want them to have master's degrees. We want to put education at the forefront of our values, and yet we pay them as little as high school employees, high school graduate employees. It is unacceptable, and all they're doing with this commission is kicking the can down past the 2020 election.
Ann makes alluded to something, which is this commission, and Luke Britt, the public access counselor, acknowledges it's not making any laws, it's not making any rules. It doesn't have to be open to the public at all. It's not open to the it's not subject to the open door laws. So, but that being said, does this just look bad?
I think there's precedent here. There's been other big commissions that have tried to address big problems, most notably Kern and Shepherd and local government reform. I mean, they basically took the same model in trying to address this. You know, this is an easy drive-by political shot, right? Because there's one teacher, there's five former educators or people who spent time in the classroom on the commission or the advisory board. There's one teacher, right? So that's an easy thing to go, well, wait a minute, it's the teacher pay commission. It should be all teachers. But that only makes sense because if you're trying to answer the threshold question, which is should teachers be paid more, we've already answered that question. Now what the complicated part is, why we pay the state trooper the same in Goshen as we pay him in Elkhart as we pay him in Indianapolis, is because they're directly paid by the state. Teachers are not directly paid by the state. They're collective bargained at the county level, and school boards control this, and school corporations control this. So we have struggled with this question all session when Ann says there's no money in the budget for teacher pay. Well, no, there's a historic pot of money for K-12 education. Now, if we want to have the conversation that the state should take over and say every teacher gets $50,000, and then the state has to figure out how to pay for it, and they take that control away from school boards, they take it away from local unions, then we can have that conversation. That's the structural debate about how do we get the money to the teachers. And what the legislature tried to do this session is said, we are not taking that power away from the locals, but we are going to put incentives in place and accountability measures in place to make sure that when we send a historic number of dollars to these school corporations, that it does get on teachers'
paychecks. 2% is not historic. And you could have done it by giving incentives to schools or to school districts that pay X. And you could have done it that way without taking local control away. And you weren't willing to put the money in it.
Send them an email.
But would we ever know about it, Mike? As I alluded to in the thing as we talked about here, there have already been grumblings about this commission because of only one active teacher on even the advisory board, not even the commission itself. Does this just feel like an unforced error by the whole administration?
Yeah, I mean, when the commission was first announced and it came out that only the one teacher and that's on the advisory board, that didn't look good. And so this is another thing where it doesn't look good. You know, private meetings don't ever really look good to the public because they don't understand why are those meetings in private. One of the things here that I think is interesting is that they've met in private, I think it says at least 6 times, as far as we know. I'm wondering what was happening in those conversations and if it was even something that the public would particularly be interested in being at. Would people have shown up for 6 meetings plus more to come? I don't know.
Yeah, they indicated they were informational meetings. These people are trying to learn about the issue and everything that goes around with it. Why not just post something on, you know, we're having this meeting, we don't know where they're getting their information from.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is one that could have been avoided. You know, have the meeting public, even if it's boring, just listing and talking about statistics and average salaries and things like that. Just have it all out in the public. Otherwise, you have people wondering, like, what are they talking about? I mean, I'm not surprised in one sense because this is basically a corporate board. And, you know, in the corporate world, you don't have to do everything transparently and publicly. And that's what these members are used to. But they need to think a little more politically.
Well, the National Democratic Party this week announced it will make it harder for presidential candidates to qualify for the 3rd and 4th primary debates later this year. The Democratic National Committee announced in February an initial threshold presidential candidates must meet to participate in the first 2 debates of the primary in June and July, either earn 1% in 3 separate polls or get donations from 65,000 individual people across 20 states. But the Democratic field has a couple dozen candidates, and most of them had met that threshold for the first 2 debates, so the DNC is raising the bar. For its 3rd and 4th debates, set for September and October, candidates must both hit 2% in 4 surveys and get 130,000 individual donors. Only about 8 candidates have currently hit that mark, including South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Nikki Kelly, the DNC was criticized in 2016 for what some perceived as rigging the system for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. Is this closer to a better balance for the party?
I think so, absolutely. I mean, obviously, you can't let 25, 30 candidates, you know, get up and do, you know, debates. That isn't good for anyone. No one's going to actually sit through that and learn things about candidates. And I don't think it's out of the realm to expect that people who want to run for president, not just get free airtime, but really run for president, have the ability to coalesce people behind them. If they don't have that basic ability, I mean, 2% or, you know, 130,000 donors, if you can't get that, then I don't really think you are a factor, and you should slowly be weeded out.
Yeah, I mean, they're higher thresholds, and some of the candidates are really starting to complain about them now, but they don't actually seem that high.
They're not much higher than, they're doubled, but the double was 1% to 2%. That's not a huge increase. And one of the things that this kind of reminded me of is that, you know, media does kind of the same thing. We look at a candidate to see, you know, are they out there? Are they fundraising? Do they have a website? Do they have a Facebook page? You know, we don't have specific standards in place about whether or not we're going to cover someone, but you have to be doing something. You have to be out there for us to cover you. And I think this is the similar thing, just on a bigger scale.
Any? Do you think there's any issues with setting these kind of thresholds?
Not at all. And this isn't a Republican-Democrat thing. This is just running a party, right, and making sure that legitimate candidates have a proper platform so they can be properly vetted by primary voters. So if you're serious, they shouldn't just let them everyone knows that part of the strategy for some of these guys is, I'm going to run for president, I'm going to raise some federal dollars, I'm going to go run for Senate in my state. Well, we're only going to give you should only have that opportunity to kind of game the system for so long before we're not going to let you just hang around and, you know, take up air.
Yeah. Is this a little bit of bad news for someone like Joe Biden, though, who's clearly the front runner at this point as far as we can tell?
Is it better
to have a lot of people out there to kind
sure,
of make
him,
more
from his
noise?
Perspective, but the fact of the matter is that he's leading simply because he has the name ID. As the numbers shrink and we get to the debates, that can change. And we've seen that happen certainly on the Republican side last time around. So I think this is a fairer way to do it than they did it last time. And I agree, if you can't get 2% of the vote, you know, why are you on the stage? So it's the way it is.
All right. Well, a $19 billion disaster aid package is being held up in Congress by individual Republican lawmakers. The long-delayed disaster relief measure has been stymied in the House over the last several days by two GOP lawmakers, Chip Roy of Texas and Kentucky's Thomas Massie. They've prevented the House from using a procedural vote to send the measure to the president. It's likely the House will approve the measure when the bulk of its members return next week. Roy and Massie both objected to the process, using a recess maneuver to pass such a major bill. But Roy also objected to money in the bill for pet projects unrelated to disaster relief and the measure's lack of funding for President Trump's border wall. The Senate last week overwhelmingly approved the bill, with just 8 senators voting against it, with Indiana Republican Mike Braun among them. Lindsay or Doty, this money is principally for past disasters, so it wouldn't be used for potential federal help for victims of this week's tornadoes, both here in Indiana and elsewhere. But does the timing of Mike Braun's vote look bad because of that?
The timing's not great, but this vote is in line with what we've seen from Senator Braun when he was campaigning and what we've seen from him so far in the Senate. I mean, he voted against the budget deal in February, you know, because he's claimed it's out of control government spending, and he's been concerned about cutting that back, and, you know, has always talked about taking his business experience to D.C. and how he's had to balance budgets and live within his means with his company. And so it's not a surprising vote, even if the timing is bad.
That's undoubtedly a compelling message to a lot of voters, the idea of out-of-control spending. I think a lot of people say, oh, yeah, absolutely, that's right. But
not this one. This one we need.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, that's always an issue with disaster spending. And it doesn't help when they insert things into a disaster bill that aren't related to the disaster. That just gets everyone's hackles up, and it, you know, everyone tries to glom onto it, and it creates problems. And having said that, exactly, I mean, a couple of the Republicans are concerned, you know, why isn't the border wall funding in there?
Yeah.
Well, it's not a disaster.
Depending on who you ask.
Yeah, yeah.
And on both sides on that one, I suppose. Is this ultimately influence much in terms of Mike Brown?
Well, you know, it's going to be interesting to see when a disaster relief bill comes forward that's going to aid central Indiana and Ohio from the last round of tornadoes and where he is on that particular bill. Because remember what happened with Congressman Hofstetler in southern Indiana when they had those disasters, and he had voted against before. You know, it is, it's always, if it's not my backyard, it's not my concern. Well, you know, we have that concern, and you can say what you want about deficits for that. They're willing to spend for the things that they think are important without any regard to the deficit. So he obviously doesn't think the people affected by disasters are a concern.
Do you think the people are okay with what Braun is doing here?
Well, I think it does fit his brand. And frankly, in the past, it is really hard to have a politically, what is always a politically popular, which is providing disaster relief, without putting accountability measures in place or audit procedures and all the things that conservatives traditionally want to see. The highest profile example of that is Katrina, when they handed out all the debit cards and did an audit on the back end and found out they were spent all the money at liquor stores and strip clubs. So I mean, so it's not popular to have that conversation, but it's necessary. I do agree with Nikki. There's got to be a little honesty in the process here, though. Don't just look for the opportunity to look at a bill that's definitely going to pass and throw your local bridge or your local fire station or the border wall on it while you're at it, right?
All right. Well, Indianapolis Mayor Joe Hogsett, in his State of the City address this week, proposed a regional fund to address critical infrastructure needs across central Indiana.
Hogsett's proposal is focused on distribution. Instead of ways to generate more revenue through federal programs or tax increases, the proposal centers on changing how existing income tax revenue is distributed to counties in central Indiana. Essentially, Hogsett keys in on the fact that a lot of people commute to the city for work, then drive home to a neighboring county, which means the income tax revenue they earn in Marion County goes somewhere else and leaves some of the most used roads in the region with less money to maintain them. For example, Marion County contributes 66% of the region's income taxes, but only collects 39% of the revenue. In the new model, 9 counties in the region would contribute a small fraction of their future income tax growth to a fund that would then be distributed based on how much each county's roads are used, according to vehicle miles traveled. Neighboring community leaders are already pushing back, saying Hogsett's proposal doesn't line up with conversations currently taking place in the region.
Mike O'Brien, a commuter tax by any other name perhaps here, but not necessarily a new idea. Still, is it time for it to become a reality?
Well, I think there is an appetite for that conversation. If you look at particularly on the north side, now Scott Fadness, Mayor Fadness and Fishers has been kind of a leader in promoting this kind of regional governance idea and a recognition that there does need to be some, you know, regional buy-in on the assets that we're all using. I think the rollout of this was a little, again, it's mayoral election year, and you don't want to give people too much of a heads up and give them time to take a shot at it. But as far as I know, this has passed the legislature, and there was no effort to reach out and say, "Hey, this is coming. I'm going to talk about this and send this proposal." So he's starting from behind if he wants to pass this in the 2020 legislature.
Yeah, is this? We were all about regional thinking when it came to regional cities a few years ago, though we know that program is no longer funded by the General Assembly. That being said, they clearly like this idea, but will they like this particular idea?
Well, you know, it benefits a city with a Democratic mayor, so, and you have supermajorities in the legislature from the Republican side. So it's automatically suspect. But on the other hand, you have so many people in the donut areas driving into Indianapolis all the time. The road funding needs to be there. This doesn't increase the taxes on anybody. It takes some of the growth money from the whole area, actually, and applies it, and it's a sensible solution without increasing anyone's taxes. We have to do something with these roads.
That's the message.
We have to do something.
Do you think this has any chance in the legislature?
I think it'll get some good discussion. I mean, the fact is the facts haven't changed. This has been discussed for decades.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there's not necessarily any new information. I do feel like I need to say that I'm a commuter, so I feel like this is targeted at me. But
it doesn't raise your taxes, though.
I didn't say it did.
So it's targeted to benefit you when you drive in.
I'm just saying it's targeted at people like me who have moved in outer and then come into the city. And that's, you know, that was our choice because we wanted some land.
Yes, but the right side of my table would be subject to this a little more than the left side of my table. But
that's true.
I mentioned there was a line in the end of the topic that already we're starting to see other local leaders go, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah, so the rollout of this didn't seem to go that well because he announced it in the State of the City address, and then the next day we heard from mayors and the donut counties who all said, whoa, like, we've been talking about this, like, regionalism and some sort of regional road funding plan, but we weren't behind you on these specifics. We didn't, you know, we didn't come to a decision on that. So it'll be interesting to see how that changes.
From an electoral standpoint, real quick, is it enough for Hogsett just to propose something like that because it couldn't possibly happen before the election anyway?
Well, it's a little bit like rallying for the hometown team at the expense of the people that are burning all these assets. So there's a little layer of that, the politics of that in here, that he's fighting for residents.
You've got to give him credit for ingenuity on this, because this is a very, because it doesn't raise anyone's taxes,
right.
Does increase the pool.
And it's revenue the government's not planning, doesn't even know it's planning
to spend.
All right,
that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Lindsay Erdody of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity on the WFYI app.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.